Hey there, I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business podcast, but when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
This episode of the Braving Business Podcast is sponsored by, well, me. I'm PJ Benoit, and I've been in the domestic and international logistics space for over 30 years. If you need any assistance with transportation or logistics, my team and I will jump at the chance to help. Whether it be parcel shipments, e-commerce, pallets and freight, full truckload, international air and ocean, imports, exports, warehousing and distribution, or really anything under the logistics umbrella, we got you covered. For more details, please go to shipwithpj.com. That's shipwithpj.com. Reach out to me there. Mention you found me on this podcast for a special surprise. And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business Podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Hey there, buddy. How are you?
I am fantabulous. How are you, sir?
I am awesome. I have a really funny story to share. If it's okay. If it's okay with you, if it's okay with Ulf.
Let me check my watch. Okay, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So actually, it's a story about music. So that's why it's an appropriate story to share. I was in the car with my girlfriend and her two children, Ty and Emma. Hi, Ty and Emma. And we were listening to a song, and I did not know the song. I don't think anyone in the car knew the song. And then there was, you know, the well, what do you call the middle part of the song, Ulf? The one that part that repeats, the rhyme, I guess. Is it rhyme?
The chorus.
The chorus. That's it. So the chorus came on, and I listened to it a couple of times, and then I sang it out loud, right? Like once, and. You know, I heard give it up. That's what I heard. I heard give it up, you know? And so I said, give it up. And my girlfriend looks at me and she goes, what do you mean give it up? It's not give it up. It's give me love. And I said, no. They're saying give it up. She's like, that's just like a guy to think they're saying give it up. It's give me love. And we're having this conversation in the front seat of the car. The kids are in the back and the music is blasting so they can't hear us. And the next time the chorus comes on, Ty goes, give it up. That's what he heard too. And Emma goes, what are you talking about? It's give me love. So there you go. The two boys in the car heard give it up and the two girls heard give me love. I don't know what you make of that, but music unites, music separates men, women.
It more allows people to take their own perspective of it, right? It's universal. So I wouldn't worry about it.
And it definitely is uniting people.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, for the record, it was give me love. That's they were right, we were wrong. But it was funny. That's what we heard.
We're going to get into exactly what royalty you are, but have there been any songs that you've written where people misunderstood the lyrics and that was the popular part of it? Because I know there are songs, of course, you know, growing up we all sang, but we were saying the wrong thing. That wasn't the actual lyric. So did any of your songs like end up that
like
that?
While I kiss this guy, who among us doesn't know that song, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have several songs that been misunderstood because they always have several meanings, the lyrics. But one which is a very big misunderstanding is around All That She Wants is Another Baby. Everybody think it's a baby, like a little baby, but it's not a baby. The song is about a manhunter. She's looking for love, well, and luck around the corner, and she's a man eater as well. But she realized in the end, it's no, you don't find love, but being with more men, and that's another baby. But so it's not a kid; it's not a guy.
Oh, I was actually, because we were, I was sharing with my wife today that, you know, we're like, hey, we're going to have one of the, we're going to have Buddha, you know, the Buddha on from Ace of Base. And she was like, oh yeah, all that she wants is, you know, have my baby. And I'm like, yeah, I think.
Well, he's another baby.
Yeah, another baby.
Yeah, yeah, another baby, exactly. But you, I mean, you're welcome to, you know, intercept it, well, however you want. It could be about a baby. But when Britney Spears did a cover of it, she actually understood the real lyrics around it. It was fun.
Oh, that's cool.
It was never released, though. Yeah, it was never released. Unfortunately, it was the time when she shaved her head a month later. So it wasn't a good, healthy time for her.
Wow.
PJ, let's tell people who the heck we're talking to. I know. To, because they're going to be like, what? They're like, wow, this is really interesting. Britney Spears. What?
Okay. Right. So we're meeting Ulf Ekberg. Ekberg. Get that name right. Mr. Ekberg, in over two decades in the music industry, he has worn hats as an artist, a producer, a songwriter, and most notably the visionary force behind the 90s pop sensation Ace of Base, which, as Ulf told us in the pre-interview, when he and his co-founder started the band, no one believed in them, like not even their parents. So, who's laughing now? Ace of Base went on to record massive hits like All That She Wants, The Sign, Don't Turn Around, and of course, Beautiful Life, which Tals told me was his anthem growing up as a teenager. And before I go too far,
I still love that song.
Well, there you go. And before I go too far and tell you more about what Ulf has done since Ace of Base, I want to mention that we'll be hearing a fun story from Ulf about meeting Michael Jackson in Monaco in the 90s. So definitely we're going to get into that. Ulf moved on from music at some point after all the fame and accolades, and or as what he calls it, he transitioned out of the limelight to entrepreneurship, which is why he's on the podcast today. Currently serving as the president of Abelou Nordics and UK, and of G2020 Advisors Nordics, all of which advise ultra high net worth individuals and families in Europe and Asia on sustainable investing. He is also the senior business advisor and ambassador to the Amazonian Fund Alliance, which supports nonprofits and sustainability driven companies dedicated to preserving and supporting innovation in indigenous communities within the Amazon rainforest. How cool is that? But folks, that's not all. I feel like I'm selling a rotisserie chicken grill on an infomercial. But wait, there's more. Ulf is also the co-founder and chairman of several tech companies, including Zoundio, which its groundbreaking augmented reality product Amped Guitar, developed in an exclusive collaboration with the legendary guitar company Gibson. He is also... Jeez, Ulf, get some sleep, man. He is also a senior partner position at Result Strategy, which has helped launch more than 300 tech enterprises and is a founding entity of Epicenter, Europe's premier innovation hub. And I'm not even going to go into some of what he did previously, because then we'll be here all day. But I'll just say that there's a lot more to know about this very accomplished man, and so Google him. Ulf, it is an honor to have you on with us. Welcome to the Braving Business Podcast.
Thank you so much. That was the longest intro I ever had, I think, in any interview so far. Thank you so much for your nice...
Well, you know what? Words. We are nothing if not thorough at the Braving Business Podcast. We have very good researchers, too. But all kidding aside, it truly is an honor. I told you before we started the interview that your band was probably my favorite band in the 1990s. I graduated high school in 1991, went to college in 1992. I think you guys came on the scene in the late 80s, but I think I really came into knowing you in like 92, 93. And you were, you know, I don't know, at the time, I think I had a Walkman still. No, probably not. I had a CD player, CD Walkman. But you are on repeat. So it's truly a privilege to talk to you and a great honor. But let's talk about, you know, the inception of Ace of Base. You talked to us about the fact that there was a lot of skepticism. And going from that to achieving the kind of global stardom that you guys achieved had to have been quite a trip. I'd love to hear a little bit about what motivated you guys in those early days, right? As you said, you told us, this is no joke. PJ wasn't joking when he said even your parents didn't believe in you. You guys really struggled to get a producer, to get a record deal. What was it that, you know, drove you guys? I mean, obviously, you were young and maybe foolish. Maybe that's the answer. But what was it that had you believing that you guys had something special?
Well, we have a special, we had a very special chemistry, Jonas and I. We were obviously a little bit stubborn as well, and we thought it was no really good music out there. So we decided to do the music we wanted to listen to. And being in a studio for 4 years, 24/7, we were very convinced that we had something great. But we needed somebody to sing on it. And actually, Jonas' sisters didn't think it was that good either. So our parents didn't believe in it. And actually,
weren't his siblings in the band? The siblings were in the band.
Yeah.
And they didn't believe it? One of them didn't believe in it? Or it was another sibling?
Both of them didn't believe in it, both sisters. So there was a very hard time to get them to put vocals on the music. But once we had that, we at least had some materials. We started to send to record companies in Stockholm. So we live in Gothenburg, which is the second largest city in Sweden. And Stockholm is the capital of Sweden, where all the record companies were based. We were sending cassettes and DAT tapes to all the record companies. We were kind of 50 of them in Stockholm. And nobody returned our tapes. Then we sent in a second term, a third term. And then we got one tape back. It was from EMI. And actually sent back the tape and asked us to never send them more tapes. Then we decided, well, we have to go to these guys. They obviously don't understand our music. We didn't have any money whatsoever. We had to hitchhike to go to Stockholm. We couldn't afford to go with the train, or especially not flying. We had no car. So we had to hitchhike to Stockholm. Sometimes it took 2 days to get to Stockholm. We had nowhere to live. So we stayed on benches in parks. And we were knocking on every single record company's door and we waited until the A&R guy was there, and we forced them to listen to the music. A long story short, nobody liked the music. And we eventually ended up finding a record company that... I got a vinyl because I was DJing a little bit. So I got a white vinyl, and we were looking for somebody that could do a drum beat for us. That was something we understood we were missing. And this was an unknown artist, unknown producer. And we found out eventually the name of the producer. His name was Dennis Pop. The song was called Another Mother. And we decided to go to this producer. And once we were in Stockholm with this record company, the producer was busy in the studio, and we kind of asked them, begged them, can you please give this cassette to Dennis Pop? We didn't know if he did or not. And 9 months later, we heard nothing. Eventually, it was one record company in Sweden who signed us, and we recorded our first single, which was Wheel of Fortune, which was a single before the big hit. In Stockholm, and it was a great experience. We were in Stockholm, but the record boss, he came back from UK in Acid, we just invented, and he came back and saw Acid and Sirens and all that stuff, and we looked at him as Klaus, his name was Klaus, you don't really know how to promote us, right? And the problem with us was that we were playing house, electro, techno, reggae, pop. We had like all the different genres, but when you were releasing a band in the record store, you had to do it by a genre. And they had no clue if we were a pop band, a reggae band, or electro band, or techno band, or synth band. And we could understand the dilemma he had, and he had no clue how to promote us. At the same time, we had just given up on Sweden, so we actually started to send tapes to Denmark. And then this record company for Denmark, after 6 months, called us and said, don't sign with anyone. We understand all the music. We understand you guys. And they signed us, and we released the first single.
Wow. Well, you know what? A lot of things come to mind as you were talking about that. And I, generally speaking, try to create a little bit of a thread to business and to some prior guests. And I'm thinking about Ray Higdon, who we recently interviewed. And I don't know whether this interview will come out before or after, but Ray's is a very, very successful best-selling author, speaker, and CEO. And he shared with us that he had this commitment that he was going to receive 20 no's a day. He wouldn't put his head on the pillow until he got 20 no's a day, which is, I don't think I've ever heard anyone have that as an objective. And here you were sending your tapes to 50, to 50 record labels in your hometown, and they all said no. And instead of giving up, you actually dialed it up and you went to a bigger city and kept on going. And so there is something up, some common thread there that I wanted to pull on. I want to ask you this question. What was your dream? What did you think Because you were also extremely innovative, right? The music that you guys brought forth, as you said, there was not a clear genre for it. And I would say that you brought forward what is now one of the most successful sounds out there, which is, you know, the combination of reggae and club and synth and all these things that you guys did, which was at the time absolutely groundbreaking. Did you see yourself as a pioneer? I mean, did you view yourself as doing something that had not been done and you just simply felt misunderstood?
Actually, I think we did. We definitely felt misunderstood, that's for sure. I think the combination of my partner Jonas was more the poppy guy and I was more the synth guy. So the combination of two skills, melodies and synth melodies and very cool electronic sounds, made the music magic. And I definitely thought that we were misunderstood. We did the music nobody else did because we thought all the music was boring, right? So, and it was even quite fun. We had a big collection of vinyls, with like 10,000 vinyls. We went through all the vinyls and to looking for who would be the producer for us. If we had a free card, and we couldn't actually find one producer if we could actually choose ourselves. The funny thing is we even had Michael Jackson there, so I don't understand why we didn't pick Quincy Jones, but apparently he didn't fit. But one fun other anecdote on this is that luck is very important as well. So when we release the first single, it becomes a hit number in Denmark and Norway. We decide we have to do a second single, and that has to be All That She Wants. So we, at that time, we said we have to get hold of this Dennis Pop. At that time, he was quite famous. He had Dr. Alban and a few other hits. So we called him up, and we were wondering why he didn't call us back. And actually said, I wanted to call you guys, but I lost your number. It was not easy to find people at that time. And apparently, he put the tape in his car, and it got stuck. For 9 months, he was listening to our songs every day because his radio was broken as well. Every day, back and forth to the studio for 9 months. So he said, you know, these guys have something, and he wanted to get in touch with us, but he couldn't. So it was just by faith, right? A lot of luck and timing in this business as well.
That's amazing. So I have a few things to cover. First of all, just right off the bat, kudos to you for being the coolest looking interview that we've had so far.
For sure.
The whole feel is very cool. So,
and you know what? We've had some really cool people. Yeah. I mean, Skip Martin, the lead singer of Cool in the Gang, yep, was here, yep, and he's a pretty cool looking guy. But
oh yeah, just the whole aesthetic's just
100%. If you're listening to this, if you're streaming this, you need to go check out the YouTube.
Yeah. It's simple, but it's spot on. Kudos. Yeah.
Thank you.
Another thing about what you're talking about is you know, really you're realizing what the market is before the market's ready for it, right? You're knowing what people want before people know that they want it. And so in a lot of ways, you know, you're kind of like Steve Jobs. So, you know, do you feel like Steve Jobs?
I wish I compared myself with Steve Jobs. He's one of my absolutely biggest favorite of all time. I've been the biggest Mac fan since 1986, so I couldn't really compare myself to Steve Jobs. But innovative for sure.
Great analogy. Yeah. It's a great analogy, PJ, because I do remember Steve would often say, "I know what the customers want before they do," and I think you guys kind of did. I mean, you. So that's great awesome analogy.
I wanted to ask. Go ahead, Alf.
Yeah, I think we, in the beginning, we didn't really knew that so many other people than just Jonas and me liked the music, but we had some feeling there were some other people. But when everybody said it was crap, of course, we started to think, who's right, everybody else or us? But we decided we were right and everybody else was wrong. So somehow we had a good feeling of what we were doing.
That's amazing. So one of the things that you also talked about, I think is deep in the heart of entrepreneurialism. And that is your total core belief in what you're trying to achieve and what you're trying to build. And so you and your compatriots, you hitchhike for 2 days from Gothenburg to Stockholm. You're knocking on every door of every record label that's out there. Of course, tenacity plays a part of that. Luck plays a little bit of part of that. You know, stuck cassette tapes always help. But could you even fathom at that time? Were you thinking about, well, if this doesn't work, I'm going to go do this? Or were you just laser focused on becoming Ace of Base?
We said nothing going to stop us, and we're going to try until we succeed. That was somehow we were. It helps to be 20 years old and be naive. Now, when I'm 53, I learned my lessons that sometimes it's good to give up as well when you have a future. But at that time, we only had one goal. It was to succeed and make sure that people could actually hear our music. We were so damn sure we were right. It's very hard to explain why. I mean, but again, it has to do to be a little bit naive as well, of course. But I love the naivety in people. I love the strength of people to believe in themselves and be strong and never give up. We were knocked down hundreds of times, but still we always stood up and we continued the fight. Well,
thank you for doing that, because otherwise Tal would have been bored during the whole 1990s. But so taking that spirit, and you kind of transition out of the limelight, so to speak, and now you're actually full on into entrepreneurialism outside of the music industry, and you're going into things like sustainability, which is, you know, not only a huge shift but also really prominent, especially now. So would love to learn more about this journey, but also, like, what parallels do you see in between, like, crafting a music from, you know, crafting a song from nothing and creating a business? Like, do you see similarities in that, or like, tell us about that process?
I think it's extremely similar. I also compare it a little bit to actually being a chef, because when you're making a dish, you need to have ingredients, which is like different instruments to musicians. You need to have a recipe, which is the song itself. And you need to have some skills to put it together. And then you need some customers to like the food. It's very much a similar thing with creating a company, whatever it is you're producing, especially if you're producing a commercial product. You need to have a production team, of course, and you need to have a management. You have to have a leader of the team. You have to have a product actually achieved and recognized by consumers. And you need to have an audience, which is customers, right? So it's very much, you drive the company the same way. You build the company the same way. And in the beginning, you have, only bread and water. You have no money whatsoever, and you fight against all odds to achieve a goal, which it's in some worlds unachievable, but you believe in it, and you don't give up even if you knock down. So it's very, very similar for me when I've been building my companies, especially in the tech industries, but other industries as well. It's been a very, very similar journey I could actually take almost every learning I had from the music industry into the other industries. Also, how the industries itself works. You have the hierarchy and the record companies. You have other obstacles to overcome in other businesses as well. It's very similar. Very similar.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I dabbled in music actually as a child. Not anywhere near your level. I was on TV in Israel though, which at the time only had one television channel, as a singer. And I recall the odds were considered, beyond the pale, right? I mean, I tried out for a singing competition that only 10 children were selected for, and there was an arena with 20,000 children waiting to try out. So the odds are enormous, and yet I had no doubt. Like, I knew I would make it. My parents tell me that story. I was 6 years old, and I was absolutely certain that I would. And so there is something that entrepreneurs and possibly musicians and other people who are creative share, which is a great, great belief in themselves and or whatever it is they're trying to accomplish. And frankly, I think that's not only healthy, it's oftentimes the only way, because you're going to get knocked down. You're going to hear no, you're going to be told that you're crazy. And if you aren't, cut out to hear those things and persevere, you're probably not going to make it. And that's true in music. It's true in businesses. Yeah. It's true in many things.
So true.
And also, you need to have passion. Passion is the key to success. If you don't have passion for what you do, you don't do a good job. It has to come from inside, from your heart. Passion is key.
Well, let's talk about passion, because we know you're very, very passionate about the Amazon rainforest preservation. I'd love to know how you came about to be passionate about that. I mean, Sweden is not that close to the Amazons, although the Amazons influence us all. I think that's probably, hopefully, something you can share with the audience who may not be aware. And I'd love to know what role do you think business has in supporting, you know, such critical causes?
I mean, I think the whole world have responsibility for what's happening, not only in Amazon, but every forest and the oceans as well. I picked to work in Amazon because I've been a lot in Brazil. We worked a lot in Brazil as a band, as a base. I've done other ventures there as well and have a lot of friends in Brazil. I've been going there a lot as a private person also, and I've been in Amazon last 20 years. I've seen how much they've been struggling, and I've seen also how much devastation has been in the forest. I mean, the Amazon rainforest is the lungs on this planet. It stands for a lot of the air we're breathing, and it's the most important forest on Earth. And it would have been destroyed by almost 20% now. And there's a reaching point when you pass that point, the whole forest will turn into a savanna, which means that it was not only Amazonas will turn into savanna, that is also connected with Africa. So all forests in Africa will be turning into savanna. So it's completely critical that we stop the devastation, burn down of the forests in Amazon for the whole world. Otherwise, we won't be able to breathe. So it's critical we do that within the next 10, 15 years. So it has to be done now. I decided 7 years ago to do something about it. I could, because I had the contacts, I had the willingness, and I had access to capital as well. But I decided I had to go the profitable way, not the non-profit way, because I've seen so many non-profit projects in the Amazon completely failing. You have to find a business model that works. So what we have created is a business model where you protect the forest and you get carbon credits from protecting the forest. You give back part of the carbon credit to the indigenous people. You educate them on better farming. You give them better technologies so they don't need to do as much cattle as they do now. They can actually use less farming land, so they don't have to burn down the forest. And then you give them – it's all about the education. And then have an open dialogue with them, because obviously a lot of the time they don't trust white people of good reasons. And then to build that bridge, and it takes time, because also they don't speak either Portuguese or English. You need to have a lot of local people, local knowledge, and it takes time to build a bridge. But we've done that with over 100 tribes now. We have an area of 3 million hectares that we are working with, which is the size of Switzerland. It's a huge project. So it will take a lot of time before we can really see the full results. But we see the first results coming out now, and it looks very promising, very good. It was hard to work there when Bolsonaro, which was the last president, because he was working against us. It's very difficult when the whole country works against you. But now when Lula won, it's much easier. And we see a lot of progress now, just the last year since Lula been in power.
Wow. Well, you know, I mean, for those of you that don't know, and again, our research team, thank you for this information. There are about 3 billion trees in the Amazon forest, and it is responsible for more than a quarter of the carbon dioxide that's absorbed by land each year. But in a really shocking development, that number is down by a third in the last decade. So considerable impact. And we're seeing it. The world's getting hotter, and we're seeing more devastating so-called once in 100-year events. And so the work you're doing is, frankly, holy work, and both in the context of saving the planet and, frankly, giving these indigenous tribes a chance. And I'm really, as on a personal level, I'm grateful for people like you that are willing to use their influence for that. You could certainly be doing other things right now, and you're choosing to do that. That as well as some of the things you do in Africa, which we'll talk about as well.
Yeah, actually, so...
Thank you. That is.
Yeah. No, please.
Yeah, no, it's not a one way learning process. I learned so much being with these indigenous people that have been there for like tens of thousands of years, and what they know about Mother Nature and how they see a life, and it's super interesting to learn new things every time I go to the Amazon. I go there like 3-4 times a year. And it's actually one of my favorite trips of the years ago, and meet these extremely smart and nature-wise people.
Very, very neat. Very cool. So you have, you know, this very diverse portfolio of that you are engaged in, everything from tech companies to supporting African tech startups. What's the thread that you feel ties all of your ventures together? And is there like a core philosophy within yourself that guides all of these directions and decisions?
Well, I think I've been very lucky. I was born in Sweden. And the more you travel, the more you realize that that's really pure luck. I haven't done, well, my parents maybe decided, well, they were actually born here too. So there was no decision from their side as well. So yes, being born in a country with so much privilege and so much possibilities, and once you're given the privilege to have a success and to travel the world, see how much need there is out there, and to see that you can actually transform and transfer knowledge quite easier to different continents and different people that needs it, and to work also with a little bit poorer countries, it's very it's not challenging because they're so hungry for information. And a lot of these countries, they just jump four generations of technologies. They go from nothing to something. They have, you know, digital wallets and Apple Pay and similar local things. And it's been, you see the results in an amazing way. I mean, in Sweden, we already had technology development for a very long time. So this obviously, of course, internet was a big thing. And now we have AI is a big thing. But otherwise, it's been more smaller, big steps. But when you go to Africa, for example, it's from being completely analog, having no internet, to suddenly have smartphones in your phone, in your hand. So it's amazing to be able to bring knowledge from, for example, Sweden or Finland or, oh, US, of course. We work with a lot of Americans, of course, as well. And to bring that knowledge and that entrepreneurship into places like Africa or South America, it's a quite easy match, and it makes sense for everyone. I mean, Africa is 1.2 billion people. So we work both in North Africa, Central Africa, and South Africa.
Well, I want to get back to Amazon for a second, but I think we probably will get back to Africa for right after that. But on the Amazon, you mentioned something that I wanted to come back to, which is that finding a sustainable and profitable model, a business model, is a real challenge. What do you think are the biggest obstacles? I mean, is it government? And do you think we're close to seeing that type of model come into reality?
I think the model we're working with carbon credits, because you sell carbon credits, you get actually is a profitable income from that. It's like selling a stock on the market, and you have big companies like Nike and Apple and United Airlines buying these carbon credit. They have to buy carbon credit, a lot of carbon credit, because they are they're leaving a lot of carbon imprints. So there's a lot of clients there, a lot of, so there is actually potentially a lot of different business models to implement in the Amazon. The biggest problem is corruption, and this corruption going through from the lowest end to the judges to the government. And that has been, and we work in Colombia. We try to work in Bolivia, but it was actually impossible. And we work mainly in Brazil. All covering the different Amazon areas. And if you look at, I mean, the second obstacle is definitely when you, if you, you have land, which you either license or you buy it, and suddenly you end up and there's drug trafficking through it, or maybe they are, you know, creating drugs there. Then you have a big problem, because I mean the cartels doesn't ask, they just shoot you, right? So we have encouraged encountered a few of those problems as well in both in Colombia and in Amazon. So it is it could be a little bit dangerous if you're not careful as well. So there's a lot of obstacles, but I mean I don't see anything you can't overcome. You just have to know about it and work around it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's very cool. One of the things, actually that I was just thinking about, I've been lucky to do a lot of travel. When we are, when you go to another country, especially to Europe, you tend to see news and stories about other countries that normally we don't see here in the US. And it's very interesting. You're doing a lot of stuff, not only in the Amazon, but also in Africa, because, we just, I don't know, maybe it's not the, what I see all the time, but I rarely hear any kind of news or developments or anything that's out of Africa, unless it's something terrible. And so can you tell us about your foray into, you know, the African continent? What kind of tech is coming out of there? What excites you about that?
So, dear friends of mine started a company called Norrsken, and they only work in impact. And they made a little review over the whole continent. Where is the less compromised and corrupt country? And that's ended up to be Rwanda. Rwanda had a very bad and horrible war a few years ago, but now been run very well the last 20 years by a great president. And it's a small country, it's only 10 million people, but they decided to go all in and to build a huge co-working space there for innovation companies. So they have added a lot of knowledge for the African people, for the Rwanda, not only Rwanda people, people flying in from Kenya, from Uganda, and from other places as well. And they have created this enormously successful platform for people to be inspired, and that's within impact and sustainability mainly. But it's definitely tech. I mean, so another technology, I mean, fintech is a huge thing, of course, in Africa, because people go from barely having cash money to go completely digital. So it's a huge jump now. And I mean, the phone operators have understood it. So working with some of the big, large corporations sometimes helps, but sometimes they are way too slow and too old as well. So we rather work with the smaller upcoming companies. I mean, in South Africa, we work with several different levels of technology companies, but you have an unemployment of like 40% of the population. So it's very easy to find very skilled people who are very willing to work. So we also decided to move some of our parts of our companies from Sweden down to Cape Town, which is a quite easy way of living, which is a beautiful place. Everybody speaks English. Everything works very well, and people are very hungry to work. And when we have winter in Europe, they have summer down there. So it's quite easy to work 6 months there and 6 months in Europe. So it makes sense for everybody. It's a win-win. Employ people down there is much cheaper for us, and they're very efficient. And for us also, we used to use Ukraine as a back-end satellite for a lot of our programming. In a lot of our companies, but also a lot of other companies here in Northern Europe. But of course, when the war started, we lost all that platform because it was a lot of it was based in Donbass to start with, but also the Ukrainians, they had to start the military service. So it was a big wake-up call 2 years ago here when we lost all the back end of most tech companies in Sweden. Wow. And we had to just do something about it. And when it was, I mean, obviously the biggest tragedy is the war itself, of course, but that's just something that affected us from one day to another. And then we now try to support what we can in Ukraine, and as much as we can to rebuild the country. But as long as there's a war going on, it's very hard to rebuild anything. But we are preparing to come and help to rebuild once this horrible war is over.
It's again, I mean, the stuff you're doing is amazing and inspiring. And I think it's rooted. It goes back to, I mean, you had a belief as a young man that you had something of value to contribute and that you can make an impact and touch millions of lives. And, you know, initially it was with your music, and now you're doing it the way you're doing that. I want to talk about, you know, the power of self-belief. It's something we talk about on the podcast with regularity. And it's challenging, particularly when you're hearing no's and when you're struggling or when your business is just getting started and you really haven't proven anything to anyone. Tell me, how do you maintain, you know, this mindset when you face new challenges, especially when you're entering industries or countries where you're forging new paths?
Well, first of all, I think the key to success is to find the right team. So you have to be very, very picky with the people you work with. And once you find the right people, you can be ready to go in and fight with them in the ring. It's like building a football team. You need to, I mean, it's not enough to just have a forward. You need to have a good goalkeeper. You need to have a full team. Once you have the team that's ready to go to, well, basically to war with you in a nice way, I mean, in a peaceful way, of course, then you can go all force in. But if you don't have the full team, you have a few, maybe it's enough with one or two person who's not perfect for the roles, then it's difficult. And then you have to restart the company and you have to rethink things. But it's all about the team. Once you have it, and there's no stop, you just have to continue until you succeed. But it's teamwork.
Yeah. Speaking of teamwork, we have made our kind, wonderful listeners wait long enough because we teased this in the beginning. You had a chance to rub elbows with the king of pop himself, Mr. Michael Jackson, back in Monaco, of all the terrible places to hang out, back in the 90s. What was that like? What was the meeting, and what did you take away from that experience?
Well, the big thing with Michael Jackson is that he united all four of us in the band, that he was basically the only artist we all thought were our favorite artists. So Jenny, Marlin, Jonas, and I, we had him as a favorite artist. And of course, for us, it was a dream to meet him. And this was probably around 95. We've already been number one worldwide, but we never met him. So we knew we were going to meet him in Monaco. We were performing at the World Music Award. But we didn't know how we were going to meet him. We were going to meet him just on stage quickly. So we really wanted to meet him backstage in his lodge. We asked our manager, and then the message didn't go through, and we were rehearsing and so forth. Suddenly we have a manager come up to Jonas and me. The girls are actually in the makeup room, and it's Michael Jackson's manager, and says, "Michael want to meet you guys." We thought it was a little bit odd because we wanted to meet Michael, but we thought it was a misunderstanding. So we came to Michael in his lodge and in his green room. And he stood up. "Oh, I'm so honored to meet you guys. I love your music." It was like we were completely shocked. We wanted to meet him and tell him we loved his music. And then he says, "I think Beautiful Life is the best song I heard in over 10 years. It was like, wow, that is some heavy words. We were speechless because we had to prepare what we wanted to say to him. And suddenly he's overwhelmed us with compliments. That was a fantastic moment. So, of course, eventually we could speak a little bit to him, and that was nice. But then we had to go on stage, and then we performed, and he performed that one. So we were at least on the same stage as well afterwards. Then I had the honor to meet him a couple of times afterwards in different. But that was the first situation. It was a very bizarre because we had no idea he knew who we were, little band from Gothenburg.
Wow, what a story. By the way, I mean, it's been a minute since you guys put out music. Are you guys still close? I mean, the three of them obviously are siblings. Are the four of you still any kind of a unit?
We met only a month ago when we got awarded. We got a few Diamond Awards, and we also got an award for 4 billion streams, which I thought was quite a lot to be a band from the 90s. And we got together, all of us, and they came to Stockholm, and it was great. Actually, Molly, we don't see so much. She didn't feel too great being famous. She was not comfortable to be famous. She wanted to actually leave the band already after the first album, so 94, 95. And when you're not comfortable to be famous and be in a spotlight, it's not the perfect business to choose to be one of the most famous bands on the planet, because people are also hunting her. So she and me was the most famous people in the band, and she didn't really want it at all. So she became kind of a Greta Garbo, and the less she wanted to be in the spotlight, the more curious people became. And she was the one who was singing on All That She Wants, because Jenny was actually in school. She didn't believe in the song and she didn't believe in the band. So she didn't even come to Stockholm to put vocals. That's why only Marlon is on All That She Wants. Jenny is a little bit on the sign, because finally at that time she understood this was actually going quite well. But Marlon was always in the front. And also when we started to work in the US with Clive Davis, was legendary record boss of all time, probably the most legendary of all time. He wanted to put her even more in the front when we wanted to put her more in the back because she was not feeling well at all. We knew she wanted to leave the band. So, you know, the American dream of being successful in America was for her more a nightmare, unfortunately, because being forced to be in the front when you want to be in the background. We knew that, but it was very hard to convince record companies, especially when they were cutting the videos and so forth, that we need to give her a break. There was nothing that the music industry understands. Music industry can be quite brutal. It is a quite brutal industry.
Oh, sure.
Well,
we're still meeting each other, absolutely. And it's 30 years ago, we were number one in America with both the single and the album Design. So it's been filmed a documentary about us for 1.5 years now. It's going to be 3 hours, 3 episodes, 1 hour per episode. And it's going to be amazing. It's going to be released now in a few months. So it's going to be great. So that's going to be unite us even more.
Where will it be released? Yeah. Is it on a streaming service?
Everywhere. I'm not sure if it's signed with America yet, but of course we're going to choose one of... It's not up to me. It's up to the production company. But hopefully we're going to sign with one of the big ones so everybody have a chance to see
Very
it,
cool.
Course.
Well, I'll be watching that. Just for the record, again, I have data up the wazoo today. And you mentioned numbers. On Spotify alone, you have over 1 billion downloads of your music, All That She Wants, just under 400 million downloads, The Sign in a neighborhood of 270 million downloads, Beautiful Life, about 100 million downloads. And The Sign, by the way, is a really interesting song. For those of you that don't know that song, it's I Saw the Sign and Open Up My Eyes, I Saw the Sign. What is The Sign? I've always wanted to know that.
Well, it's sometimes when you're looking for answers and you see it somewhere. I mean, The Sign could be a little bit what you want, right? Mm-hmm. But it's really to inspire people. It's always a possibility. It's always a solution to any problem you can encounter.
What a cool, inspiring song.
And your nickname.
Thank you.
And I do some research too, you know. And your nickname is.
Oh, come on. Neither one of us has any research.
Yeah, I know, that's so true. But your nickname is Buddha, which I find very interesting, especially since I look more like Buddha than you do by all stretches of imagination. How did you get that nickname? And do any other band members, do they have nicknames?
Yeah, so, first of all, Jonas have a nickname, Joker. That's because his humor is, he has a lot of humor. Not really good humor, but a lot of humor, which is fun. He almost mostly laughs at his own jokes, but he loves to be called Joker. My Buddha, it's when I was very young, I trained karate and jiu-jitsu, and I learned a lot about Zen and Buddhism, and I talked about it in school, and that's why people started to call me Buddha. So it was not because I was fat, it was more because I talked about Buddhism when I was very, very young. Originally, Jonas and I, when we didn't really know if we were going to have two sisters singing, if we were producing, so forth, we took these names because every producer had nicknames, different DJ this and whatever that, MC that. And we said we have to take some nicknames. So then Buddha was natural for me, and he is the Joker. So he took Joker. Marlene is called Lynn because she doesn't want to be Marlene official, and Jenny is just Jenny. So she's the only normal person in the band.
You know, since you
were become more and more. Yeah.
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
No. So over the years, when we're older, we don't use Joker and Buddha so much. But when we do autographs, we still do Buddha and Joker. That's our autographs.
Wow.
When we're signing.
I want to ask you about Eastern philosophy. I speak in front of oftentimes students, high school and college, and I talk about how I view meditation as having made a significant impact on my life, not just in terms of my personal wellness, but as a business person. Do you meditate? What is your way of centering yourself? And do you feel that has an impact on you as a professional?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that is, I think, very important is actually looking in the mirror and look yourself in the eyes and see, are you honest to yourself? Are you doing the right thing? Also be able to criticize yourself and understand what you've done wrong. Learn from that. Do it again. Do it right the second time. Doing wrongs, enough, nothing wrong with doing wrongs. So actually, it's a best way of learning to do wrongs. Doing wrong once is nothing. Do twice is too many. So my meditation is very much to talk to myself and try to understand what actually I do think, what do I feel, what do I want to do, what do I want to achieve with this, and to try to be as honest as I can to yourself, because it's quite easy to lie to yourself. But you have to take that those moments and just turn everything off and just to really be you know, honest to yourself. That's my own meditation. I don't listen to any meditation tapes or music, but my peaceful temple is, funny enough, when I'm flying long haul flights. I make sure I don't sit next to anybody I know. Fly comfortable. I read a book or I watch a movie or just think, listen to music. That's the best way for me to actually meditate, because I know nobody can disturb me now for 9 hours or 12 hours or 15 hours. And that has been my savior over the years. Been traveling 250 days a year. I still travel 250 days a year. So I still a big traveler. But I mean, during Ace of Base, it was more 300 days a year. And wow. But you needed that time way, to be yourself a little bit.
What do you listen to nowadays? What's the music that you're listening to?
So you know what, I'm pretty, when at the gym, I actually listen to Spotify's list they make for me, and they're very good with the algorithm. They understand what kind of
they're
music
amazing.
I like.
Yeah,
and I discovered so much new music. I like electronic deep house music, but of course sometimes I want something more soft. Chill out.
Is there an up and coming artist that you're really into? Somebody that's really caught your eye?
There is, but I won't be able to say the name, because I know the name. I know the songs, so I don't know the name of the artist always. But
all right, I'm going to follow up with you
more
afterwards.
Research on that.
I want to know what you're listening to.
Yeah.
Because thank our you. Musical tastes yeah. have to be very similar, given yeah. the kind of music you've created.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So
probably is
one of the mantras that you had mentioned that you live by, or that you know, you always say that there are no shortcuts in building business enterprises. And so there's a lot of logic in that. Can you give an example of from your own experience of where taking the longer road or the long road actually was essential to the success of what you build?
Well, I guess one example could be when in the music business. So we were lucky to be signed with the Danish record company. They only had distribution in the Nordics with a brilliant mastermind, Kjell Wennick, who's unfortunately passed away a few years ago. And he was so sure our music would be global. So he wanted to pick the right record companies everywhere. So in Europe, we picked one group, which is called Polygram, now it's called Universal. But in every country, we picked the best Polygram company. So in Germany, Metronome, London Records in the UK, Barclays in France. We handpicked every record company we thought, or he thought. We had a little bit to say in it as well, but what he thought was the best for us, who can actually bring the best to the table for us, to believe as the best, the most in our music. Same thing as we didn't release it in America, North America, or Japan to start with, North and South America and Japan, because we needed the right partner over there, somebody to believe in us. And Arista Records, where Clive Davis was running, Kjell Wennick thought he was the number one, the only guy. He was the king of pop, except for Michael Jackson. He was Clive Davis was the king of pop, creating pop artists. he did Simon Garfunkel, Bruce Springsteen, Whitney Houston, Puff Daddy, you name it. He's done so many number one hits. And Kevin said, it's only Clive Davis is going to work with the US. But Clive Davis, he rejected us 3 times. And but he didn't give up. And that's why it took a while for us to be signed in America. But we hit with All I Should Want in America before he signed us. So he came back from a vacation in Europe, where he'd been traveling from Spain to France to Italy to Greece. And we listened to All I Should Want, Happy Nation, and Wheel of Fortune everywhere, in every club, restaurant, radio station, whatsoever. And then he came back to the US and he opened up a billboard, and we were in one chart, like a grunge chart or something, crazy grunge chart, together with Nirvana. obviously, our music is so far from Nirvana you can be. But he saw us in one, with some popping up list, obviously not the main list, but we reached there because all the DJs, American DJs, been in Europe and they've been playing All the Show Ones, and it brought it back and started playing it on radio. And through all the massive radio play these DJs did, we ended up on the charts. And then it's decided, I have to sign this artist before somebody else do it. And that's how we ended up in America. But it was no shortcuts here. We were waiting for the right people, and we waited 2 years until we did the right record deal in America. And that was obviously a great choice, because when we signed with Clive, I mean, he had a lot of ideas, and we already had sold 8 million albums. Hard for the modern audience to understand what 8 million albums is, but in streams, but it's 8 million albums was very, very few bands in the world that sold 8 million albums. And so when Clive says, I need another hit, we were like, I mean, we already have like 5 singles out there, which is hits. They're releasing the 6th single now. So he decided, no, I won't release it if I don't have another hit. So we have already started recording a second album, because we've been around for 2 years. And he said, I'm coming to Gothenburg, and I'm going to listen to your second album. And our second album was actually named The Sign. So our main first single we were planning to release was The Sign. He said, I can take that. And he picked Don't Turn Around and 2 other songs. So we added 4 new songs on the album. And they said, now it's a good album. And of course, we thought it was insane, because he destroyed our second album. He took all the singles from our second album. But we went from 8 million albums now 27 million albums, which obviously was a brilliant mastermind move for him. And he made us number one in America and Canada and South America and in Japan.
I got to say, that record, I remember vividly, the one of the interesting things about the record back then, of course, you'll remember, you had to buy the record. And so you would, you know, you buy a record and you'd like 1 or 2 songs. And that was one of those rare records where every song was pure gold. Every song. I mean,
thank you.
Legendary. Thank you. We are coming around the bend. I want to ask you one final question. And, you know, we generally speaking ask our guests to share some advice they would give young entrepreneurs or people starting out in business. They're not always young. Sometimes people are pivoting in mid-career to entrepreneurship. What is one piece of advice that you would give someone that's either considering entrepreneurship or is already committed to it and is just starting that journey?
Find people that inspire you. Try to find a good mentor in life. It really helps to have somebody with experience, because you learn so much from somebody that's been around for like 30 years. Always try to be the most stupid guy in the room, because that means you learn a lot every day. And just be very observant. And find something you're passionate about. Don't go into business just because you're going to make money. That normally doesn't work. The ones who succeed is the one that are passionate about what they do.
I love that. I'm also normally the stupidest person in every room I go into. So I feel you.
He's so not.
What do you think, just real quickly, about luck or kismet or good fortune or however you want to say that? How much do you think that actually plays in success?
Enormously a lot. I think you need to have luck, timing, and talent. Without these three, you won't be successful. And you have to have the patience to find that spot, because you can have the best product, but the wrong timing. I mean, Ace is a perfect example of that. We were talented, we had a lot of luck, and we were the right timing. We came at the right time. So if we were released 10 years earlier or 10 years later, it wouldn't have worked. But it worked at that time because of that. So you need all three of these ingredients, which means you have to be patient to wait for that time when all the stars are aligned.
Love it.
Great answer. And I couldn't agree with you more. You know, we are currently, PJ and I are collaborating on a new startup, and it's a great idea. And it's something we think the world desperately needs. I don't know if the world necessarily knows it yet, but I don't think it's that far a reach. And there's no question. Ultimately, you know, but we have a great team. We have, I think, a great product, but luck will play a role. And I say that, as I talk to entrepreneurs, on this podcast and in my consulting practice and in general, there's no shame in good fortune. And you may not be able to plan for it, but you can increase your odds of it. And one of the ways you could do that, as you mentioned, is mentorship, finding people, who are willing to lean into you as an individual or to your idea or your company, and open doors. There's no shame in that. It's not cutting corners. It's actually how it's done. Our guest today was the absolutely incredible Ulf Ekberg. His music has been a huge part of my life. I feel just privileged to have had the opportunity to talk to you today. Congratulations on an incredible career and on everything you're doing now to make this world that we live in a better, more sustainable place. We're really grateful to have had you, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. You're an amazing show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it.
And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube. And please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.